General Westmoreland, General Lemonser, Mr. Secretary, General Decker, General Taylor, members of the graduating class and their parents, gentlemen, I want to express my appreciation for the generous invitation to come to this graduating class. I'm sure that all of you who sit here today realize, particularly in view of the song we have just heard, that you are part of a long tradition stretching back to the earliest days of this country's history, and that where you sat once some of the most celebrated names in our nation's history, and also some who are not so well known, but who on 100 different battlefields in many wars involving every generation of this country's history have given very clear evidence of their commitment to their country. So that I know that you feel a sense of pride in becoming part of that tradition. And as a citizen of the United States as well as president, I want to express our high regard to all of you and appreciation for what you are doing and what you will do for our country in the days ahead. I would also like to announce at this time that as Commander-in-Chief, I'm exercising my privilege of directing the Secretary of the Army and the Superintendent of West Point to remit all existing confinements and other cadet punishments. And I hope that it will be possible to carry this out for today. General Westmoreland was slightly pained to hear that this was impending in view of the fact that the one cadet who I'm confident will someday be the head of the Army has just been remitted for 8 months and is about to be released. But I'm glad to have an opportunity to participate in the advancement of his military career. My own confinement goes for another 2.5 years, and I may ask for it to be extended instead of remitted. I want to say that I wish all of you the greatest success. While I say that, I'm not unmindful of the fact that two graduates of this academy have reached the White House, and neither was a member of my party. Until I'm more certain that this trend will be broken, I wish that all of you may be generals and not commander-in-chief. I want to say that I'm sure you recognize that your schooling is only interrupted by today's occasion and not ended. Because the demands that we made upon you in the service of your country in the coming months and years will be really more pressing and in many ways more burdensome as well as more challenging than ever before in our history. I know that many of you may feel, and many of our citizens may feel, that in these days of the nuclear age, when war may last in its final form a day or 2 or 3 days, before much of the world is burned up, that your service to your country will be only standing and waiting. Nothing, of course, could be further from the truth. I'm sure that many Americans believe that the days before World War II and the days of World War II were the golden age, when the stars were falling on all the graduates of West Point, that was the golden time of service, and that you have moved into a period where military service, while vital, is not as challenging as it was then. Nothing could be further from the truth. The fact of the matter is that the period just ahead, in the next decade, will offer more opportunities for service to the graduates of this academy than ever before in the history of the United States. Because all around the world, in countries which are heavily engaged in the maintenance of their freedom, graduates of this academy are heavily involved. Whether it's in Vietnam, or in Laos, or in Thailand, whether it's a military advisory group in Iran, whether it's a military attaché in some Latin American country during a difficult and challenging period, whether it's the commander of our troops in South Korea, the burdens that will be placed upon you when you fill those positions, as you must inevitably, will require more from you than ever before in our history. The graduates of West Point, the Naval Academy, and the Air Academy in the next 10 years will have the greatest opportunity for the defense of freedom than this Academy's graduates have ever had. And I'm sure that the Joint Chiefs of Staff endorse that view, knowing as they do and I do, the heavy burdens that are required of this Academy's graduates every day. General Tucker in Laos, or General Hawkins in Vietnam, and a dozen others who hold key and significant positions involving the security of the United States and the defense of freedom, you're going to follow in their footsteps. And I must say that I think that you will be privileged in the years ahead to find yourselves so heavily involved in the great interests of this country. And therefore, I hope that you realize, and I hope every American realizes, how much we depend upon you. Your strictly military responsibilities, therefore, will require a versatility and an adaptability never before required in either war or in peace. They may involve the command and control of modern nuclear weapons and modern delivery systems, so complex that only a few scientists can understand their operation, so devastating that their inadvertent use would be of worldwide concern, but so new that their employment and their effects have never been tested in combat conditions. On the other hand, your responsibilities may involve the command of more traditional forces, but in less traditional roles. Men risking their lives, not as combatants, but as instructors or advisors, or as symbols of our nation's commitment. The fact that the United States is not directly at war in these areas in no way diminishes the skill and the courage that will be required. The service to our country which is rendered, or the pain of the casualties which are suffered. To cite one final example of the range of responsibilities that will fall upon you, you may hold a position of command with our special forces, forces which are too unconventional to be called conventional, forces which are growing in number and importance and significance. For we now know that it is wholly misleading to call this the nuclear age, or to say that our security rests only on the doctrine of massive retaliation. Korea has not been the only battleground since the end of the Second World War. Men have fought and died in Malaya, in Greece, in the Philippines, in Algeria, and Cuba, and Cyprus, and almost continuously on the Indo-Chinese Peninsula. No nuclear weapons have been fired. No massive nuclear retaliation has been considered appropriate. This is another type of warfare, new in its intensity, ancient in its origin, war by guerrillas, subversives, insurgents, assassins, war by ambush instead of by combat, by infiltration instead of aggression, seeking victory by eroding and exhausting the enemy instead of engaging him. It is a form of warfare uniquely adapted to what has been strangely called wars of liberation. To undermine the efforts of new and poor countries to maintain the freedom that they have finally achieved. It preys on economic unrest and ethnic conflicts. It requires in those situations where we must counter it, and these are the kinds of challenges that will be before us in the next decade, if freedom is to be saved, a whole new kind of strategy, a wholly different kind of force, and therefore a new and wholly different kind of military training. But I have spoken thus far only of the military challenges which your education must prepare you for. The non-military problems which you will face will also be most demanding, diplomatic, political, and economic. In the years ahead, some of you will serve as advisors to foreign aid missions, or even to foreign governments. Some will negotiate terms of a ceasefire with broad political as well as military ramifications. Some of you will go to the far corners of the earth and to the far reaches of space. Some of you will sit in the highest council of the Pentagon. Others will hold delicate command posts which are international in character. Still others will advise on plans to abolish arms instead of using them to abolish others. Whatever your position, the scope of your decisions will not be confined to the traditional tenets of military competence and training. You will need to know and understand not only the foreign policy of the United States, but the foreign policy of all countries scattered around the world who 20 years ago were the most distant names to us. You will need to give orders in different tongues and read maps by different systems. You will be involved in economic judgment, which most economists would hesitate to make. At what point, for example, does military aid become burdensome to a country and makes its freedom endangered rather than helping to secure it? To what extent can the gold and dollar cost of our overseas deployments be offset by foreign procurement? Or at what stage can a new weapon system be considered sufficiently advanced to justify large dollar appropriations? In many countries, your posture and performance will provide the local population with the only evidence of what our country is really like. In other countries, your military mission, its advice and action will play a key role in determining whether those people will remain free. You will need to understand the importance of military power and also the limits of military power. To decide what arms should be used to fight and when they should be used to prevent a fight, to determine what represents our vital interests and what interests are only marginal. Above all, you will have a responsibility to deter war as well as to fight it. For the basic problems facing the world today are not susceptible of a final military solution. While we will long require the services and admire the dedication and commitment of the fighting men of this country, neither our strategy nor our psychology as a nation, and certainly not our economy, must become permanently dependent upon an ever-increasing military establishment. Our forces, therefore, must fulfill a broader role as a complement to our diplomacy, as an arm of our diplomacy, as a deterrent to our adversaries, and as a symbol to our allies of our determination to support them. That is why this academy has seen its curriculum grow and expand in dimension, in substance, and in difficulty. That is why you cannot possibly have crowded into these four busy years all of the knowledge and all of the range of experience which you must bring to these subtle and delicate tasks which I have described. And that is why you will go to school year after year so you can serve this country to the best of your ability and your talent. To talk of such talent and effort raises in the minds, I'm sure, of everyone and the minds of all of our countrymen, why? Why should men such as you, able to master the complex arts of science, mathematics, language, economy, and all the rest, devote their lives to a military career with all of its risks and hardships? Why should their families be expected to make the personal and financial sacrifices that a military career inevitably brings with it? When there is a visible enemy to fight in open combat, the answer is not so difficult. Many serve, all applaud, and the tide of patriotism runs high. But when there is a long, slow struggle with no immediate visible foe, your choice will seem hard indeed. And you will recall, I am sure, the lines found in an old sentry box in Gibraltar: God and the soldier all men adore in time of trouble and no more. For when war is over and all things righted, God is neglected and the old soldier slighted. But you have one satisfaction, however difficult those days may be. When you are asked by a president of the United States or by any other American. What you are doing for your country, no man's answer will be clearer than your own. And that moral motivation, which brought you here in the first place, is part of your training here as well. West Point was not built to produce technical experts alone. It was built to produce men committed to the defense of their country. Leaders of men who understand the great stakes which are involved. Leaders who can be entrusted with the heavy responsibility which modern weapons and the fight for freedom entail. Leaders who can inspire in their men the same sense of obligation to duty which you bring to it. There is no single slogan that you can repeat to yourself in hard days or give to those who may be associated with you. In times past, a simple phrase, 54, 40, or fight, or to make the world safe for democracy, all that was enough. But the times, the weapons, and the issues are now more complicated than ever. 18 years ago today, Ernie Pyle, describing those tens of thousands of young men who crossed the ageless and indifferent sea of the English Channel, searched in vain for a word to describe what they were fighting for. And finally, he concluded that they were at least fighting for each other. You and I leave here today to meet our separate responsibilities, to protect our nation's vital interests, by peaceful means if possible, by resolute action if necessary, and we go forth confident of support and success because we know that we are working and fighting for each other and for all those men and women all over the globe who are determined to be free.